Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and with the company this time of Jennifer Walsh for her latest epistle from the collapsing space of art and tech. Composer Dave Flynn has his own files containing the unique sounds that fill the air of Aotearoa, New Zealand. But we begin in a quiet part of central Dublin on the edge of Fellows Square, TCD. Much of the attention / column inches / moral panic / dinner table hilarity about recent developments in what Jennifer Walsh calls AI has been in the area of writing, the weird beard output you might get from putting just the right prompt into ChatGPT. But for one group of scholars, at least as interesting, are the reading capabilities of machine learning tools. One of that number is Jennifer Edmond, a professor based at TCD's Center for Digital Humanities. She specializes in the area of computational literary studies, a type of computer-aided research that leverages the machine's ability to read vastly more books in a vastly different fashion from humans. That's roughly it. Culture File visited Professor Edmond in her office at Trinity's Long Room Hub to learn more, including how Thomas Aquinas helped give the field its start.
My name is Jennifer Edmond. I'm Associate Professor of Digital Humanities, and we're here in the Trinity Long Room Hub in Trinity College Dublin. I work in the field of digital humanities. It's a new interdisciplinary field where, in some cases, we take the affordances of technology and we use them to learn more about disciplines like literature and history. And in some cases, we actually turn that around and we use all the things we know about culture to learn more about technology. I actually did my PhD in German language and literature. And at that time, so I finished in the late 90s. We won't say exactly when I finished. This is when internet technology was just taking over. At the time, I was living in the US. That's where I was born and raised. And that allowed me, internet technology allowed me, if I was teaching German in a group, I could use today's news today rather than collecting newspapers in the summer. What then happened is I happened to fall in love with an Irishman and I emigrated to Ireland in the early 2000s. And at that point, I was facing a kind of a professional change. And I actually left academia for a while and I worked in technology. I worked kind of supporting people doing research, using technology in their research. And I became so fascinated with it that I actually ended up kind of working my way back into the research field and sort of becoming an expert sort of through the back door. It's not a path I can recommend anyone follow.
Yes, it sort of explains why the English professor writes Python. I don't think all English professors write Python.
Oh, no, not all English professors write Python. But it is, again, increasingly, if those are the kinds of questions you're asking, it's a lot easier to write a bit of Python than to read all the books and highlight every occurrence of the word them. We have a number of projects here in my lab, and they run quite a wide range of approaches. Some of them look at things like how AI and big data affect democracy. Some of them look at things like food manufacturing and how we can bring a cultural dimension to the technologies behind that. But we also have one really important project looking at computational literary studies and how we can better build the kinds of infrastructures that both literary researchers, but also people who work with narratives and work with stories, can access the literature of the ages.
So tell us what computational literary studies are. Where do they come from as a discipline?
Well, they kind of are sort of what they sound like they are. It's about doing literary studies, which we've done for hundreds, if not thousands of years, using, well, our ability to read. But now what we can do is we can read not just in the old tried and true way, but we can also read different ways using software. So we can look for particular patterns, particular words, particular grammatical structures, and we can use that to ask different kinds of questions and sometimes come up with different kinds of answers about the literature of the past and the present. So the field actually goes back to the 1940s. We have a founding father who was a Jesuit priest who wanted to actually be able to build a better index of the works of Thomas Aquinas. So that goes back a very long way. But between then and now, you'd see a lot of work coming from examples like in computational linguistics, where you'd have people interested in specific words. And that gradually made its way out of linguistics and into literary studies, where we're actually interested more in sort of the big picture and the wider level patterns of narrative and dialogue and character development and plot. So you can really see how it has very, very deep roots back almost, you know, not quite all the way to the beginnings of the history of computing, but quite early on, and then brings us quite into the present, where we're seeing it become a much more accepted and consolidated part of most or many literary scholars' ways of approaching their work.
In this 1940s example, what kind of technology is enlisted? What's the project for the priest?
So Father Busso, when he brought his project to IBM, he really wanted to say, I want to see, you know, what is kind of almost like a concordance, what they would have been, you know, creating handmade concordances of Shakespeare going back, you know, almost as long as there was Shakespeare. So what he wanted to do is find a more effective and faster way of building that concordance so he could see what words were mentioned where. And that importance of what kinds of expressions exist in texts that we think are important are really at the kind of foundation of this approach to literary research.
When you say important, we're talking about quantitatively, that when there's a lot of some occurrence, we think it's important.
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. In fact, one of the first things we often have to do when we're doing this kind of research is take out a list of what we call stop words. Because for many researchers, the word a or I aren't that important. But if you have only one occurrence of a really significant word, we did a project on a novel in German where there was a couple of really distinctive compound words, you know, like the social something, that's one word in German. And the fact that that particular word was used in a particular case was really important for us, but we could see that that was an outlier. We could see that only occurred once, but we could see that there was something very specific about it. So sometimes we take out the little words, and sometimes the little words are actually what you want, because little words are often indicative of other kinds of things, like literary style. So it's really about how you work with your data, depending on what your research questions are.
You say it has long roots into the 1940s, but the current era in this kind of computational literary studies kind of coincides with the arrival of Google and the internet and big data.
Sure. And the big data aspect is really important for us because in most cases, look, you wouldn't do a computational approach on a single poem. If you can grasp it quickly with the eye, with the sort of the innate reading tools that we are kind of taught to have as children, you don't need anything bigger. But then when you have these collections of long novels and you want to start seeing patterns, you really have a different kind of, it's a different kind of question you want to ask when you're looking at thousands of novels instead of thousands of pages or even thousands of lines. So we can see how now that we can assemble large corpora of novels, large corpora of literary text, that's when we need the new tools to let us get the most out of them.
It's sometimes described as distance reading, which to sort of make the differentiation between what was once called close reading. Can you tell us a little bit about that debate or that transition maybe?
That kind of goes back. That's a kind of a language that I think was really comfortable for literary scholars to take on because close reading is really important to us. So how do we come to something that's different? And the scholar Franco Moretti came up with this paradigm of saying, well, if close reading is what we're used to, then all that we're doing now is combining that with this paradigm of kind of stepping back. So rather than seeing one tree, you know, rather than going leaf by leaf and branch by branch through the tree, we can step back and we can see the forest.
So what is the output of the computer? What is the in and out form?
So in will take, so say we have a corpus of novels and we'll feed them in. Depending on what we want to do, the tools can be more or less complicated. Many people will work through a programming language like Python in order to say, okay, find me all of these. Show me all of, you know, every time that the word milk is used, show me what sentence it's used in, because I want to understand what the context is around this. So there's a lot of basic things like that keyword in context or the most often used words that you can get from these kinds of tools. And so when you have your clean data and you feed it into one of these kinds of tools, then the output will be usually a bunch of you know, words matched to numbers. And oftentimes we'll bring that then into something else in order to say, okay, well, visualize this for me. Well, show me how these things relate to these things. Sometimes a bar chart is used, sometimes a pie chart, sometimes a scatter plot. You use the visualization that helps you to see the patterns you want to see. So if it's a geographical pattern, you might visualize it on a map. If it's one that compares the number of times something's happened, you might do that with a bar chart.
Impression of the literature can you get without reading it? If you work in this way, there is no need to read any of the literature, and you can accomplish your aims without that.
If you don't read the literature, your insight into what the patterns you see mean is going to be relatively uninformed. So you can come up with a paper that says, yes, there are 17 occurrences of this important word in this book. But what does it mean? Why would the author have wanted to do that? What does it say about the time and the place where it came from? So generally, it's not that it makes it so that we don't read the books anymore. We may not read all of the books. And that's what's really exciting is, you know, look, you're only going to live so long. You only get to read so many books in your life. What this approach allows you to do is, rather than saying, okay, now I'm not going to read any books, it lets you say, okay, I've got, you know, I'm going to live to maybe statistically, you know, 90. In that time, I can read so many. How do I choose well? So it might be that, okay, I'm really interested in books that have a certain kind of representation of place. These computational methods can help you find those books. Or it might be that you find a bunch of books and you want to know what brings them together and what other ones are like them. Computational methods can help you do that better. So I'm afraid we're still going to read books. I think we're still humans.
That sounds a little like it might be a super recommendation engine is one of the prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny because there have been people in our field. There was one very famous now PhD thesis that produced a monograph about what makes a bestseller. And as far as I know, both the author of the PhD thesis and her supervisor have now been hired by a very big tech company. They looked for patterns in books that sold well and said, okay, well, this is the book that actually ticks all those boxes. And actually, it was a bestseller. So it's interesting how you can start to think about recommendations that aren't, you know, I like this pink cover, or aren't I like chick lit, but things that are like, well, actually, I like books where you have a narrative arc like this. I like books that have this kind of vocabulary. I like books that have this kind of balance between character development through narrative and character development through dialogue. You could imagine asking those kinds of questions. And yeah, this kind of infrastructure could let you do that.
And then closing the gap there, the idea would then be to have that written by a machine as well. Like, why waste all that insight, take all of that insight out of the digital domain, just let it all happen in there.
Oh, so we're just going to let GPT write our articles now. Well, that would be great, because if I could do that, then, you know, I could spend all my time actually on the beach. But I think at the end of the day, the whole reason why people gravitate towards literary studies is because they find these narratives compelling. And we find these narratives compelling because they allow us to connect with people across time and space. If that is coming out of a machine, I mean, let's face it, these machines are not creating anything new. They are distillations of all of what people have said in the internet. You know, there's human utterances behind them. They are statistical models of human utterance. Something created by a computer could be quite interesting. At the same time, it's not going to respond to new things that happen in the world until after we do. It's not going to create the next aesthetic paradigm. It's not going to be the amazing fresh thing that comes out. And it's also not going to give the pleasure of simply writing. And I think we take pleasure from writing, and we take pleasure from the arts, just as we take pleasure from seeing how other people have responded to these same things. So while it's interesting, I don't think we're ever going to be as moved or as connected to that kind of writing as we are to the writing of other humans.
One of the stereotypical misgivings about digital humanities in general is the idea that the work would become quite useful, in a sense, that you are trying to find things that have, if you're building tools, you're trying to find things that have use in the world beyond a kind of academic circulation. How do you feel about that kind of productivity aim?
So I'm a little bit of a radical here, and I do think that whereas we have a very strongly developed tradition of basic research in literary studies, we haven't developed the applied literary studies that most other disciplines would have, a basic and an applied arm. Now, there have been very useful pieces of digital humanities developed. One of the most well-known was a piece of work done on Agatha Christie and her Alzheimer's and how her language in her books changed as she was getting more and more ill. And that was actually kind of brought back into a medical context where they were able to say, okay, well, actually, can we use narratives like this to diagnose the level of progression of disease? So those kinds of examples I personally find really inspiring because narratives are everywhere. They're all around us. So if they're going to be there, then understanding how they work, understanding what we need and want from them, you know, as you say, this oncoming new technology, which might, you know, take from us the kind of human written literature. I don't think we want that, or maybe we do, but if we understand better the role of stories in our lives, then we know what the right answer is.
Professor Jennifer Edmond of TCD there on the emerging uses of literature. A little bit of Tui and some kakapos next as we encounter the bird sounds of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Composer Dave Flynn, the instigator of the Memory Orchestra and other Irish contemporary music projects, spends half of the year in New Zealand. There he's become increasingly fascinated by the highly specific sounds that fill the air. Calls from birds such as the Tui and the kakapo and the bellbird have found their way into his own compositions, including a new orchestral piece he's written incorporating all manner of calls he's recorded and transcribed. Dave Flynn brought some of his haul to Culturefile Towers along with a MIDI demo of the new work.
There was a little Tui sound.
What's that?
That's the Tui, and it's an extraordinary kind of bird that's endemic to New Zealand. You only find it there. And when I first went to New Zealand, it was the first bird I noticed, and it was by its sound, because before I went to New Zealand, and this was end of 2014 or early 2015, I was there for the first time. And I was just walking around an Auckland suburb, and I heard this strange sound, and I thought it was R2-D2, a kid with an R2-D2 Star Wars toy, but then it kept going, and I looked up, and there was this extraordinary looking bird, the Tui. And
what do you see when you look up?
Well, it's beautifully coloured. It has its most distinctive feature is this white tuft just at its kind of neck area, and then you see it vocalizing, and this, it's kind of unbelievable to think that these sounds are coming out of the beak of this bird, you know, like, and it seems to sometimes be like it's throwing its voice, you know. It's everything that you hear in the recordings I've made are actually a Tui, no electronic manipulation or anything like that, and they're renowned as imitators. They imitate other birds.
So that's a Tui. Do you think that bird is imitating something? Or what's its natural call? Is there any such thing?
Well, there's definitely some of its normal sounds there. You're hearing like the cracks and the whoops. But there is... I just detected this listening to it closely through the night, that it's imitating a bellbird. So that's just the bellbird, and that's Tui again. But sometimes it can be hard to tell whether you're listening to a bellbird or a Tui, but the Tui tends to be more eccentric, and it tends to just, I call it like the avant-garde composer of New Zealand birds, because it just, you know, goes all over the place. And that's just one particular tui in one particular area. Like there's
Will you know the sound of one particular bird? I mean, if they're kind of these accretion of sounds, how would you know it was that bird rather than a series of other sounds making birds and devices?
Yeah, it can be tricky. Like, it's particularly hard to distinguish the difference between a bellbird and a tui in the distance. But if you listen to the recording there, that's bellbird imitating tui. The thing about New Zealand and the wildlife on New Zealand, the endemic wildlife, is that it was there for thousands and thousands of years before any human settlements. So the whole of New Zealand, or Aotearoa, is how it's also known by Maori when they settled, it just was a whole load of forest. For an awful lot of New Zealand, was just loads and loads of forest. And there's accounts, you know, from both Maori and European settlers talking about the birds, and just the back then when they were first experiencing them, there was way more birds, and the sound of the dawn chorus was supposed to be completely spectacular.
Do we want to go to the kakapo now?
Yeah, yeah. So the first one, this is the fairly simple mating boom sound.
Quite turned on.
That's all it does. And the kakapo is a flightless parrot, quite a big parrot. Doesn't fly, even though it has wings. Apparently it can glide downhill. That's why it still has the wings, apparently. It was going downhill. But yeah, that's its mating call. And I liken that to like a bass clarinet, a low kind of toot on a bass clarinet. Or you could think of it as like something that might start a Prodigy song or something like a electronic dance music sound. But it's, when you hear the female response, you mightn't think that she's that impressed by it.
Okay. This is the kakapo female sound. This is an actual sheet of music with New Zealand birds, NZ birds at the top.
Yeah, so this is just some of my transcriptions of what I've heard, figuring out how to put them into sheet music. Obviously, you can't see them on the radio, but I can just explain. There's extended technique kind of notation. You can see here, they're not clear notes, they're crosses instead of the kind of round note heads, and that's getting those percussive sounds that you hear in the tui.
So where's the little tui sound that's the first thing we heard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a little flick.
Describe that little piece of notation, that tiny bit, would you?
Oh, that's just an ornament, a grace note, they call it, and it's a really quick one. I've put what they call demi-semi-quaver, which basically indicates to a musician that you play it as quickly as possible. So you barely hear the note before it. And that's very common of Irish fiddle playing and piping. So, like, it's funny. I wondered if some of the... Because there's quite a few Irish tunes that are, you know, named after birds, blackbird and things like that. And I wonder, did some of that influence of bird sounds come into Irish flute and piping and fiddle playing, you know? Or is it just a technique that's necessary on the instrument? I mean, I don't know if anyone could ever answer that, but it's funny that some of these little ornaments the birds do are similar to ornaments you find in traditional music all over the world. And then there's too many birds now to individualise them, it's just kind of building them all up. Tui, the last word at the end of the piece. It builds to a huge big orchestral kind of climax, and then just that kind of at the tui.
Dave Flynn and friends there, and you also heard an extract from a demo version of the composer's Patea. And finally this week, Jennifer Walsh's further journeys into artificial intelligence, or should I say AI? I should indeed, for reasons that will become clear. This is Jennifer Walsh's Things Know Things.
Last week, I spoke about how thinking of artificial intelligence as an energy drink can provide a useful metaphor for trying to understand how AI is changing the world in which we live. All that caffeine and taurine has me feeling very productive, so this week I'd like to introduce another metaphor for AI. AI as AI. When I say that AI is AI, understand that AI is in bold and there are quotation marks around it. Because this is radio, I'm going to say it in a terrible robot voice every time, just to make that clear. So, why is it useful to think of AI as AI? Because AI is an incredibly powerful meme. AI is sci-fi. It's AI the movie, along with every book or show or film featuring friendly teddy bears, killer robots, or sexy disembodied operating systems you can tell your problems to. AI is software and devices with agency. It's the future, which we thought had been cancelled. AI is excitement and fear, which is itself a form of excitement. AI is transhumanism, living forever, the dream of bringing someone back from the dead. If you're in the AI business, AI is more money than you can dream of. It's a slide on a billion pitch decks, the word at the tip of the salivating tongues of 1,000 venture capitalists. For artists like myself and many others, AI represents new, undreamt of forms of art, genres which no one has ever heard, ways of making art and music which are beyond our comprehension, just over the horizon of the vibe shift. For researchers, AI is a completely fascinating encounter with the nature of human consciousness, a way of trying to understand intelligence, which is a way of trying to understand what it is to be alive. But it's important to separate out the actual technology, AI, or more accurately, machine learning, which is a subset of artificial intelligence, from AI, because AI is a beautiful dream, a potentially wonderful future, but it can also be a scam. More often than not, AI is the smokescreen capitalism hides behind. When the New York Times writes that AI is coming for lawyers, or The Guardian headlines a story, AI is coming for Hollywood script writers, they ascribe agency, and more importantly, blame to AI. AI is coming for Hollywood script writers is a headline drawing on the meme of AI for clicks and drama, not for accuracy. Because the more correct headline would be, humans are founding companies which use machine learning technology to write scripts in a bid to profit hugely by eradicating the need to pay human script writers for their skill. AI isn't coming for your jobs. Neither is AI. But humans are coming.
Jennifer Walsh there with some home truths on AI, which is how everyone should say it now. It's a movement by now.